From TexasObserver.org and KOOP, this is Observer Radio, a half-hour discussion of Texas politics and culture with the staff and friends of the Texas Observer magazine. I'm your host, Patrick Michaels, and I'm joined this week by Observer politics writer Christopher Hooks. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Patrick.
And Observer columnist and senior political reporter for RH Reality Check, Andrea Grimes.
Hello.
Hey, Andrea. And former Observer staffer and now freelance writer for many fine national news outlets, Abby Rappaport. Hello, Abby.
Hey, Patrick.
So on this week's show, we'll discuss a dark and troubling episode in Texas history many in the state would rather not revisit. And when we're done talking about Battleground Texas, we'll discuss Abby's dispatch from Gainesville in the latest Observer about a little-known episode of Civil War paranoia that became the deadliest act of mob violence in the nation's history. First, though, Battleground Texas, launched in early 2013 when a cadre of seasoned Obama campaign veterans appeared onto the Lone Star State, promising with their mysterious data tools and a new pipeline to DC money to relax Republicans' grip on Texas politics. This month, Battleground faced their first big test. And Chris, how'd it go?
Well, not very well. You can kind of divide the criticisms of Battleground into two categories. People are focusing on Battleground, not because they're the sole group to blame for what happened in the election. The outsized margin means that there's a lot of blame to go around. A lot of people kind of screwed up. But Battleground, as the organization that was handling the kind of Democratic coalition's turnout efforts and voter registration efforts and kind of giving the data for everyone else to do their jobs, does stand some to be targeted with some criticism. There are some specific examples of things that they did that contributed to the huge margin that Democrats lost by in November. And a lot of them, you could say, were probably avoidable if they had listened to people on the ground. One thing that you could say about Battleground Texas is a lot of the people that were involved in starting the group were involved in presidential campaigns. And in presidential campaigns, the kind of model, when you go into a state like Ohio, is to, you fly in from D.C., and you come in with, the wisdom of Solomon and more money than Croesus. And you kind of like you go to these county parties and you tell them, this is how it's going to be. These are the voters that we're going to hit. And here's the strategy going forward. And I think on some level, they kind of brought this approach with them to Texas.
And we love being told what to do by people from outside of Texas.
Yes, we love it more than anything in the world. And it went over about as well as you would expect. And from day one, there was a lot of fighting with local groups. And some of that was, about ego and turf and the kind of the things that you would expect. But there was also cases in which, people in Dallas and in Houston and in other places were telling them, these are kind of the things that you have to do, whether it was about messaging, about how to kind of go and talk to voters, or about like what they should expect election cycle to election cycle. And one thing that's always been true in Texas is that Democratic voters just don't show up to the polls. I mean, it's very difficult to get them to vote. And in terms of their modeling, when it came close to Election Day, Battleground assumed that more of the Democratic base was going to turn up than had in 2010 after a lot of money had convinced them to do in 2010. They assumed that a lot of people were just kind of show up and didn't necessarily need to be targeted and talked to in order to get them to do that. And a lot of people, it's my sense, were telling them that was not the case and they didn't listen to them. So those are things that Battleground Texas definitely deserves some criticism for. But the kind of larger question about Battleground is something that it's been a problem for Democrats for a long time in Texas, and that in Texas, it's the state party itself, the state party structure, which is strong in some other states, is not necessarily very strong here. And a lot of the organizing work that's done is done as a result of these groups that sit outside the party. And there are these groups outside the party in a lot of other states, and there are reasons for them to exist. One of them is that campaign finance laws mean that certain kinds of money can't go to the state party, or it gives people a greater amount of freedom to do what they want with their money. But in Texas, the result is that a lot of these outside groups and the kind of consultants around these outside groups have an outsized amount of power in making the decisions. Those guys are based in Austin. And the coordination, hypothetically, it could be the case that all of these outside groups and the people in Austin and the people in different regions coordinate. And the different outside groups do different things, and everyone kind of works together on the same team. And that's definitely not what happened this year. And it's not what happened. It's not what has happened in past cycles too. So kind of the big question for Battleground going forward is if it's able to find a way to work with local Democratic groups and the state party in a way that they weren't able to this election cycle. And there are some signs that it's going to be very difficult for them to do that, which raises questions about what kind of power they're going to have next time, or should they be around next time? Because that's a question too. So the Battleground wants to develop itself into this big organization outside the party, which is kind of a repository for data and which is absorbing a lot of Democratic volunteers and money. And the Texas Democratic Party would very much like to see that go through itself. And for reasons that are kind of understandable on both sides. But on Saturday, this weekend, the state Democratic Executive Committee is going to meet, and a lot of people in the party are going to kind of be talking about these issues. And so one touchstone that's come up right now is Battleground has a list of information about all of the volunteers that helped it this election cycle. I believe it's about 34,000 people. And that's a very important list for a lot of people. That's very important data. So it's a list of people. It has their contact information. And these people are much more likely to volunteer to be part of a campaign. If you email them, they're going to be more willing to give you money. It's a very important list. And Battleground has taken all of these volunteers over this election cycle, many of whom who would have thought that they were working for the Democratic coalition or were volunteering for Battleground because they wanted to help Wendy Davis, and that was the way to do that. And Battleground has this list and has told local party groups and the Democratic Party that it's not going to give them that information. And that's something that's really irritated a lot of people in the Democratic Party who think that they deserve that list or would like to have that list.
So is it fair to speculate as to their motivations if they're not just all on the same team, all trying to get as many Democrats elected as possible? Why might they at this point still be holding on to that data?
Well, there's a lot of different opinions as to that. I mean, some people think that the organization is in it for the money or it's aggregating power and resources to itself. I think that's probably too uncharitable. I mean, a lot of people with Battleground kind of still have this attitude of that they've come down and they know what needs to be done, and they're going to do it. It becomes a lot more difficult for them to make that case because of the size of the loss this election cycle. I mean, there's really nothing that they can point to that they did well, and so a lot of the people that have been criticizing them through this election cycle kind of have the ammo they need to say this is not a model that works. It's not going to work.
I mean, the obvious thing, right, that I keep thinking of is, of course, that it's not as though Texas Democrats had a model that was working, and suddenly it's not, right? Like, it wasn't like, the sort of bleak truth is you're always comparing, like, the size of losses, and they're all big. I mean, this is part of the reason I think everyone was shocked was because what people had kind of, I think a lot of Democrats I had talked to had convinced themselves of was like, well, it's a win if she loses by less than Bill White. And many people thought that was, and so that's sort of what counts as a win in Texas politics, I think, for a lot of Democrats. And, you can see why. But it's not, it's fairly weak, right? Like, and so it's not as though, I think the counterargument, right, that the Battleground could make would be to say, well, people may have volunteered with us because they'd already lost faith in sort of existing Democratic institutions. I mean, I could sort of see that argument having some justification, although as you say, there's sort of obviously like justification on both sides.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, and there are a lot of people that have lost faith with the Democratic Party in Texas for very good reason. And that's also true with Battleground's donors. There are a lot of very rich people in the state who have a lot of influence in kind of the broader constellation of Democratic politics who are giving money to Battleground because they don't want to give it to the party. And you can also see why that's the case. I think the problem is if you're there has to be a greater level of cooperation, and I guess the question is between local groups and state groups and these issue oriented groups like Annie's List or there has to be the closer degree of cooperation, and if what Battleground wants to do is kind of turn itself into this power block sitting outside the party which has control over these important things it's not clear to me that they're ever going to get to a place where they can work with, like, the Harris County Democratic Party or, like, local candidates. You know, there were about 10 legislative races that Battleground was involved in, it was a mixture of Republican incumbents and Democratic incumbents in open seats. And they managed to hold on to one of the Democratic incumbents, but they lost in these other 9 races. And if you talk to the people that were involved in these legislative races, you find out that there were a lot of groups in Austin and individuals and groups like Battleground who are kind of setting and controlling their strategy and making assumptions that were just were very, very bad and contributed to the losses there. Democrats are going to have to figure out whether they want to consolidate within the Texas Democratic Party, which has its downsides, or if they're going to go with a big group like Battleground.
When I was reporting earlier this year on a story about Battleground, I went and talked to Samina Kermali, who ran against Jody Lobenberg. And the sense that I got going in to talk to her, I was very excited to talk to her about Battleground and how Battleground was working with her and what all they were doing for outreach. And basically she told me Battleground wasn't helping her all that much, that they were not investing resources in her race, that, you know, a lot of those resources were going to Wendy and pretty much only to Wendy. So I wonder how much, when we talk about the work Battleground did in Texas, what was that work? Like, where were they in these kind of lower down races? Do we believe them that they were doing as much pavement pounding as they said that they were doing?
Well, I think that, Samina Kermali is an interesting case because she was like a very long shot candidate. Mm-hmm. She was in a very Republican district, but I think that's also a question, that maybe you could ask. I don't necessarily know what the answer is, but, the kind of like the 10 or so legislative races that Battleground got involved in were like the races that everyone would have picked. Those are the races that, like, kind of the Austin consultant class, and I don't necessarily mean that in a disparaging way, but they would have picked. Those are the kind of obvious races. Mm-hmm. And when Battleground came in at the beginning, you know, what they said that they were going to do was, you know, get involved with local races or mm-hmm. kind of be organizing in these places where there had not been a lot of organizing done and reaching out to voters that had not been reached out to. So mm-hmm. does that necessarily fit with their model? I don't know.
That's sort of the point of the Battleground name, is that we're making a battleground where there wasn't one before.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm struck by, to Andrew's point, like, I also wrote a story about Battleground early on, and I remember, you know, it was before they had a candidate, mm-hmm. and they were really emphasizing the long-term strategy, like, you know, bottom-up building. And then not the minute, but seemed like pretty close to Wendy Davis's announcement, they up and moved their entire headquarters to be next to her headquarters. Mm-hmm. And I felt like the sign that gave to everyone was, we're in it for this. You know, it was no, like, these claims they had made, well, we're long-term, we're, you know, starting small, you know, we're not starting small, but we're starting at the bottom. Per the Drake song, right? but that seemed to... They sort of seem to shoot holes in their own theory from my perspective, or their own sort of claims from my perspective. I don't know, Chris, was that?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely – so a lot of people will make the case that they jumped in it too soon. But I guess the counter case is, you know, what would they have done if, if once Wendy ran, they kind of had to get behind that. Or there was like a certain logic to getting behind that. They couldn't, like, after all of the hype that they had gotten, they couldn't, like, you know, continue working in local races in Harris County and let Wendy Davis flounder, because Wendy Davis was the candidate that people were excited about. I don't know. It seems like there's something more fundamentally wrong with the model that is going to have to be addressed.
Yeah. And I think there's also the issue that in Texas, progressives and liberals and Democrats are very – the diversity of issues that those people, us, are interested in is huge. You've got people that are worried about immigration, people that are worried about water, people that are worried about the environment, people that are worried about abortion. And I think this is a problem generally with the Democratic Party, is they don't know where to start with all of these issues. The Republicans have done a great job of carving out some particular, like, really hot button, like, really hammering, you know, open carry or anti-abortion laws, things like that. And so, you know, you got something like Battleground that's coming in
trying to start at the bottom in a million different races, in a million different cities where the people, you know, Lubbock has different interests than Houston does. And so it's, again, like, I think they're so not saturated. Yeah. It's a really, like, shallow kind of all over the board problem.
Sort of thing where it would happen.
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. Well, you'd be an advantage to be working with the local activists who've been there for a long time and know what those issues are.
Yeah, right. I was going to say, like, I went down to Houston once and talked to people at Texans Together, which does a lot of, like, hyper grassroots work and sort of trying to engage communities that have longstanding low turnout and kind of disengagement. And one thing that most people who are active in that work seem to say is that when you start with these issues, in a way, you're already starting at the wrong place, right? Mm-hmm. Because those feel so foreign to a lot of folks who have never really been involved in politics and, you know, don't really know, you know, it feels very outside. And so one thing that I know, like, Texans Together starts with when they're trying to do kind of outreach and organizing is to say, well, what's something in your community that you need? Oh, it's a speed bump so that, you know, cars can't go 80 miles an hour past your kid's, you know, bus stop. Well, let me show you. You can write to city council and actually you can get the, you know, speed bump really easily. Of course, the problem is when you're starting at that level, I mean, you're talking decades, right? Like, that's a really long process. The problem is I feel like there's almost – that's actually what's never happened in Texas in any great way. And we kind of keep starting in the middle and then are surprised that these sort of – you know, the where we need to start isn't catching up. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think that's – in Battleground's case in particular, I mean, they came down with knowledge that they had acquired working for the Obama campaign in Ohio. And Ohio is, like, one of the most politicized states in the country because it's been a perennial presidential battleground, and people are tuned into politics. And you may have to in a way that they just aren't in Texas. And in Texas, there are these huge communities that are apolitical or depoliticized. There's several steps of engagement that are probably needed here to reach out to Democratic voters. That is, it's different than an Ohio style kind of get out the vote campaign. And it's also, to your point, I mean, it's a huge state, and there are all of these regions in which the politics is different and the people's relationship to their communities are different. Mm-hmm. And I think one criticism that you see of Battleground a lot in this campaign is that it kind of ran a cookie cutter approach across Texas. And so what they were trying to do in, like, Harlingen was similar to what they were doing in Houston to El Paso to Dallas, et cetera, and that probably does not work as well as it would in another state.
All right, we're going to shift gears now from current events to a disturbing slice of Texas history that one North Texas town has been grappling with anew, an incident known simply as the Great Hanging. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio from the Texas Observer and KOOP Radio in Austin. Abby, I've brought the beginning of your story here, and I thought you might just read from it to sort of set the scene of what we're going to discuss here.
Sure. On the gray and rainy morning of October 1st, 1862, about 70 men were roused from their homes in Gainesville and corralled inside a vacant store under arrest on suspicion of treason. Within 13 days, approximately 80 more men had been captured. The town's citizens' court, made up of prominent community leaders, immediately found 7 men guilty by majority vote and promptly hanged them from an old tree. As tensions mounted, a mob grew angrier outside the store, worried that the remaining men were not just seditious, but bandits, John Brown supporters, or friendly to the Indian tribes that frequently attacked the area. Within a little over a week, 40 men had been hanged and another 2 shot trying to escape the rope. The Great Hanging of Gainesville entered history as the largest act of mob violence.
So I think a lot of people don't know about this, and yet it's such a dramatic, sort of terrible incident.
Right. I mean, you know, sort of the next sentence is basically, and then it was forgotten for over 100 years, which is sort of amazing when you consider the scope of what happened, you know, at a time when there wasn't a ton of people in Texas.
You know? You sort of hint at people. There were a lot of different reasons why these folks were getting rounded up. And so maybe that's one reason that's hard to sort of categorize what was going on. But what were the forces here? Like, what?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, right? Because so when I first heard about this story, I heard about, you know, going and looking at this, you know, hanging. It's very controversial in the town, whether you call it a hanging or a lynching or what you call it. But I sort of assumed, I mean, in the South, you know, I assumed for one thing it wasn't white men, right, which it was. And in North Texas, I sort of had, I realized how many assumptions I was bringing to the table about sort of Texas at that time. And what it turned out is that, like, North Texas in particular was this place in tremendous transition then, in some ways as it is now, right? You had a lot of new people coming in. You had all the tensions kind of from the Civil War slowly making their way into the Texas sort of mindset. But in the meantime, there were a lot of other pressures that these people were under, Indian attacks, a sense that, you know, nobody was really taking them seriously and their needs seriously. And really, several times they'd had to turn to kind of vigilante justice as the only means to sort of hold people accountable. And so it's sort of an interesting kind of crossroads when the Civil War starts.
So we should talk about that and why we're talking about this at all today. You know, the headline of the story on our site is how do you memorialize a mob? And this is the year that they're finally commemorating this incident with a plaque in the mm-hmm. city. So and you've been there and you've talked to folks who have different ideas about how we should be talking about this incident in Gainesville's past. How do they talk about it today?
So 100 years after the Civil War, Texas starts going around putting up plaques. And they put up one for the Great Hanging. But at the time, there's really very few accounts that are available. The courtroom documents sort of get lost sometime in the 1920s. There are two written accounts, but neither of them are really published. And so you sort of have, you know, one or two versions available. And so this marker goes up in the 60s. It's basically like the town dealt with its treasonous citizens. And, you know, it's almost like a sort of, you know.
Sounds good.
Good job, right? Yeah. And so that's in the 60s. And then some of the families, one family in particular, the Clark family, has never left Gainesville. And around 2007, one older gentleman, Leon Russell, who'd actually grown up nearby in a really small town called Woodbine, first learns about the Great Hanging. He'd never heard about it at all. He'd grown up nearby, you know, knew a lot of people from Gainesville, and learns about it from a friend who's a Civil War buff. And he decides, well, somebody needs to memorialize this. So it's the first time, you think 2007 is the first time there's really a public memorial, public ceremony of any kind recognizing the victims. And what he does is he's interesting. He's a disabled fellow. He and his family go all the way out to Home Depot, buy some wood posts, and make 42 white crosses, and proceed to ring a bell and read out the names. And that was the sort of turning point. After that, several people started to get more involved. And by 2012, there's an effort led by a guy named Steve Gordon, who is actually not even from Gainesville, but moved there as a retiree and became fascinated by its history. So in 2012, he leads an effort to have a larger memorial, larger kind of recognition of the event. In the effort to do so, he and the Cook County Historical Society, along with the museum called the Morton Museum, put up a billboard that says Gainesville's Reign of Terror, 1862, or something along those
billboards
lines.
Billboards are, if you have like a subtle message you're trying to get across in a nuanced way, like a billboard.
Right, exactly. And well, this billboard caught the attention of several city councilmen who are not as pleased. And you know, when there's a lot to understand about it, because the town is done a lot of has been very involved in a number of efforts in recent years to get recognition. As they won this national competition to be America's most patriotic small town. It's very popular. A moniker they're very proud of, and they've started this program called the Medal of Freedom, where they call themselves a Medal of Freedom City, where anyone who's won the Medal of Freedom is invited down to Gainesville, and everything is free, and the town cheers them on, and there's a parade and all these things, and so they have a sort of strong identity, and most of the people, their families weren't around, right, in the 1860s. And so if you talk to someone like the mayor, he sort of says, well, we deserve to be known for the things we've done in the last, you know, several decades. What does the sort of great hanging have to do with who we are now as a city? But for people like the Clark family and for people like Steve Gordon, who's sort of really involved, the history is really important. And one of the most interesting things was talking to one of the members of the Clark family, a woman named Colleen Carey, who still lives on part of the land that her great-great-great-grandfather, who died on the elm tree, right, that he lived on. She, you know, she almost talks about a sort of, you know, serious connection with these, you know, relatives hundreds of years that, you know, precede her by hundreds of years or 100 years at least. And I think for her, there's such a strong feeling of debt and obligation, right? And so they tried to do this thing in 2012, and the city council, several members of the city council aren't happy about it. And there's sort of concern about whether the funding for the museum is going to, you know, be in peril. So they back off, everyone sort of. And it takes two more years before they end up raising enough money to do a memorial on its own. There are some interesting things that come out in between those 2 years. For instance, the town actually had a park donated, a plot of land that became a park donated for the express purpose of having a memorial. And they just sort of hadn't done anything with it. That was in the 90s. And so, you know, I think that ironically, even though the 2012 Reign of Terror billboard debacle was for some people extremely frustrating, it actually moved the ball forward in a pretty significant way to the point where in October they were able to have the unveiling of a pretty serious monument or memorial in the park that had been donated 20 years before.
So just the last question, how do you think that folks in town feel about it now that there's some resolution, it's commemorated in a more formal kind of way?
Well, I'm still, you know, not sure that people who weren't involved in this are aware of it. It's a nice park, but as I say in the story, it's a park that sort of is a work in progress. So, for instance, when I went out and saw it, it was shown it in late September, it was hard to ignore that it sort of looked a bit like a vacant lot, you know. And then they got the memorial up, they got the stones up, they're getting pavers, they're sort of getting benches. So I think, you know, the memorial itself, the physicality, has the potential to sort of be a education tool. But I think it is surprising the number of people who are completely unaware of the history, even now, even after the struggle and the several years of debate.
It's amazing. Well, they won't be if they read your story. And you can find a link to that and to Chris's piece about Battleground, Texas, in the show notes at texasobserver.org. So thanks, Abby, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks, Chris.
Thanks.
That's it for this week's episode of Observer Radio. Thanks, as always, to Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music for our show. And thanks to all you listeners. For more sharp reporting from the strangest state in the union, visit us at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of The Observer at fine booksellers around the state.